Hi, everybody. Welcome back to No Killing Goblins. Today's episode, we have a special guest. It's going to be just me and said special guest. It's Melis D, or the Wonderful Delta from the TWI Discord, a writer and a fan of The Wandering End. Say hi, Delta.
Hello, I am Delta 201, or Melis D, and I am the author of a few web serials like Melis Salvos Tien, Trace Violet, and a few more, which I just recently started. So, yeah,
just a few, not too many, right?
Not all that much compared to how much pirate writes, anyways.
I suppose that is a certain marker to test yourself on whether or not you've made it. Can you write 40,000 words a week? No, you're not there yet.
Yeah, sadly, I can only write 30,000 words a week. I'm not at that level.
Okay, what got you started reading up on The Wandering End, Delta?
I mean, I was, this is actually a bit of a long story. I was basically, quote-unquote, depressed because I got rejected from, like, Harvard and, like, all my dream universities. I only got into, like, my safe pick, which was UCLA. So I was, like, it was over the summer, and I was, like, oh, I don't know what to do. I hadn't watched, like, anime and all, like, that stuff, like, in years, so I just binged everything, you know, to, like, make myself feel better about getting rejected from, like, Harvard. Then I went on Reddit, and I was like, oh, I mean, I started, like, reading light novels. Then I was like, oh, I read all the light novels, which were basically good out at the moment. Then I went on Reddit, and I was like, oh, what is some light novel-styled story which I can read? And someone recommended The Wandering End to me, and And that was my first foray into English web serials.
You'd never read anything before on Royal Road or a web series online?
I have not. I don't even read much Royal Road right now, like, or even after that. Like, I think I basically read like 5 web serials before I started picking up writing.
Wow.
And I mostly stuck to reading The Wandering Inn. Like, other than like Worm and Ezrinth Healer, I mostly stayed, you know, interested in The Wandering Inn.
Have you read Western, like, science fiction and fantasy, or are you mainly based around, like, anime and Eastern?
I mean, I read, like, a lot of, like, Western novels when I was younger, like Goosebumps, or, like, a lot of Enid Blyton books, but most of them were, like, children's books. So they aren't, like, I never read, like, Sanderson. I started reading, like, after I picked up writing, and that was just to study his style, like the way he does world building and lore and all that stuff. But like Patrick Rothfuss and like all those other big fantasy authors, I have never read them.
I wasn't actually thinking of them, since honestly, Brandon Sanderson and Patrick Rothfuss are, oh God, I feel old saying this, but they're the recent writers. Mostly when I think of classical fantasy and really diverse fantasy, it's writers from like the 90s, 80s, and 70s. People like Ursula Le Guin and Tanya Huff and
Then the answer is no, I did not read them.
You should. I know that's saying, I mean, I'm telling a writer that they should read books, but yeah, you should. It's like, it teaches you a lot, especially Lois McMaster Bujold. I finally got Pirate to try some of the books, and of course they love them because, you know, Lois McMaster Bujold is the best, and I've been shilling for them for like 30 years. It's just, okay, sorry, I don't want to get lost talking about all those other writers.
It's fine. Go ahead.
I do it all the time. You should hear me just go on and on about this book. I'm going to be honest. I only read one of your series, Salvos.
Oh, yeah?
Mostly because I'm in the same boat in that, like, as far as web serials go, I've been reading The Wandering Inn and Beware of Chicken was the other one. And other than that, I haven't really been picking up a lot of web serials recently. Most of my reading has been novels because, ironically enough, it's because novels are shorter than web serials nowadays.
That's understandable. Like, you like slice of life, don't you? Like, Beware of Chicken and The Wandering Inn are both very slice of life at times.
What I like is when a story surprises me.
Yeah.
The Wandering Inn uses slice of life as a device to draw you in, and then what did someone once say? War crime, slice of life? That's Pirate Abba's.
Yep.
You'll have war crimes sliced between, yeah. So it surprises me. It's the same with Beware of Chicken. It's a genre version. It's a surprise. If a story can't surprise me or isn't interested in engaging with me on an emotional level, but is rather an intellectual exercise, I'm probably going to respect the writer's abilities, but I'm not going to enjoy it as much, which will make it hard for me to read. I don't know. Is that the same for you?
No, that's the thing about that's wonderful about Slice of Life is that it lives off of like surprising the audience. Like, oh God, I'm gonna sound like a massive weeb, but like, have you watched Spy Family? It's like an anime that's airing right now.
You think that makes you a massive weeb? Of course I'm watching Spy X Family.
All right.
Who are you talking to
All
here? I'm a 30-year-old weeb. I was there before you were, so shut
right, all
up.
right. Look.
I watched Dragon Ball before it was cool, dude.
Dragon Ball still isn't cool, but Dragon Ball Z and Dragon Ball Super are. So many people have watched both of those while watching Dragon Ball. And anyways, that's a side tangent. Yeah, like if you look at Spy Family, like the entire premise is like built off of surprising the audience, like subversion. It's not a full-on subversion, but it's a bit of like a subversion where like a character is introduced and you think he employs a certain trope, but then the character is revealed to like not be that at all.
Before you go too far into it, just for those folks who don't watch anime too much, Spy X Family is a recent anime that came out this year. The premise is that there is a master spy, and he has been assigned to go to another country, with the capital being named Berlin.
Oh my God.
I'll pause right there for a second. And he's supposed to infiltrate this prestigious school by getting married and having a kid. And having the kid become friends with the
The son of his target, which is basically like the prime minister of the country or something.
right, and then figure out things and send back. And it's super important, and the world's peace hinges on it. And it turns out he's not really great at being a family man, so and he inadvertently wifes up an assassin, and the girl he picks up at the orphan, Anya, who is now the best girl ever, fight me on it, is a telepath.
Yeah.
It's a bunch of weird genre flexes and mixes that ultimately, as Delta was saying, surprises you.
Yeah, that's the core of Slice of Life.
Yeah, I think it's part of the core. I think the other aspect of it is grounding that kind of surprise in a emotional core to it.
Yeah.
It has to have a reality to it. So it's about three people finding out how to be a family when they didn't even know they needed a family.
Yeah, so it's like relatability and just surprising you. Like it's not just like surprising you for no good reason. That would be more akin to like a horror suspense movie, you know?
Yeah, now that we've discussed the definition of slice of life and revealed ourselves as massive weebs, let's go talk about The Wandering Inn. Today's episodes we're going to be covering, I think it's the first goblin chapter of this volume. I don't know. It's 2.27G and 2.28. So we're starting with the first goblin chapter.
I think it's the first true goblin chapter. There were previous goblin chapters, but they involved Torrin as well. And this chapter was when it was just purely rags and like, oh, it was so good. I loved it.
I think it's also the first like G label chapter. So tech, yeah, you're right. It is the first ever goblin chapter. I mean, it's all about rags, right? What did you think of it?
Oh, I loved it. It was when Rags, she basically just outsmarted and like beat. Wait, fuck, am I looking at the right chapter?
Yeah, you're in the right chapter. This is when she beats the Red Fangs, or quote unquote beats the Red Fangs.
Oh my God, cause I looked at the wrong chapter earlier. And, oh yeah, so this is when she beats the Red Fangs, and it wasn't like just through sheer like power or strength. Like she outsmarted Garen Redfang, and she saved him as well. Like she gave him a healing potion and stopped him from dying, and he made her chieftain because he wanted someone to beat the Goblin Lord.
Is that what his, did he state that in this chapter?
Yeah, he mentioned the Goblin Lord in the chapter. Is it not?
He tells her about the Goblin Lord, but he doesn't tell her that he wants to beat the Goblin Lord, I don't think.
Oh, okay. I just skimmed
It's
this
okay.
just now, so.
No, it's cool. So what I remember about this chapter that sort of was the biggest thing to me. It was cool that Rags was outwitting her opponents a lot. She was using the fact that she's so much smaller to her advantage. She used knowledge. She was really tactical. To be honest, Rags felt like the MC in every story a little bit for this one, right?
Yeah, she felt like like the underdog. It's like a typical underdog story, but it's I don't know, it's executed in a way which I really liked it. Found it really believable. And maybe it's because she's like a side character compared to Eren. Yeah, I really enjoyed the chapter.
I mean, that's the core of how Pirate does it. Pirate stealths in main characters by pretending that they're side characters.
Exactly.
Or in my opinion, Pirate makes sure that every character feels like a main character when they're front and center.
Yep.
I don't even know what to say because I'm not a giant fan of the Goblin storylines early on. I did enjoy the chapter as far as like understanding goblin philosophy, how the dynamics of how you become a leader works. You beat them once, and then it's like she says, there's a wonderful line where she says, it only matters if you win once, right?
Yeah.
It's all about just in generally, like, there are casual mentions of cannibalism in this chapter where she beats one of the, I think, Hobbs, and she literally leaves the body where it lies because maybe they'll eat it.
Yeah, but it's because they need to survive. It's just so grim, but it's like so casual about it.
That's what makes the writing so, I think, realistic, is because there's no I ignoring the reality of goblin life, which is survival of the fittest at times. It can be super bloody, super dangerous. It's all about conflict and about trying to survive with as few resources as possible. It's a struggle, and it's well represented.
Yeah, and it's Pirate also like captures the social dynamics of the goblins very well. Like they don't feel like just humans reskinned, like in sci-fi, like you have a lot of like societies which are like, oh, this is like some advanced alien civilization, but they are basically just humans with a very eccentric personality. Goblins feel like they still have everything like grounded, like in reality, but they also just feel different from us.
Like, what kind of things make them different from humans? I don't know.
Their dialogues, I really like goblin dialogue, especially like early on when it's like very truncated, it's very like everything they say is just necessity. They don't have like small talk.
I almost feel like the small talk happens in subtext. You know the concept between high context languages and low context languages?
No, you can explain it to me.
So a high context culture or language would be someplace like the like Chinese or versus English, which is low context, where everything changes based on the context of the conversation. Like the language itself shifts around context. I'll use my own culture, like Bengali culture. You have a different way to greet every single person based on who they are in relation to you. In American culture, you just shake hands and say hi.
Right.
You know,
Yeah.
it's the simplest way I could think of it, but it's all just about goblin language to me felt like that. Like they're nonverbal and like their position to each other is like they know of it instinctually, right? They know who's supposed to be goblin and not goblin. And there's so much subtext to that, right?
You're right. Like, that's the word I was looking for. It's all instinctual, There's like a very complex social dynamic that's like relayed just through subtext alone, and it's done incredibly well.
Pirate does an amazing job of pulling us into it, and you don't even feel like the language or the prose kind of pushes against that.
Yeah.
You're just pulled into the story, and you just feel it, and you know it. And for those, like, I think that's the best of what makes Pirate so good when they do write the Goblin chapters, and why people react so strongly to it. My personal opinions aside, it does connect with people a lot. People love the goblins, right?
Yeah, and one thing I want to mention, this I believe that this is the first ever chapter which mentions the heredity of the Goblin King, like the Goblin King's memories. It has Rags recalling like the Goblin King's voice in her head,
Right.
and I don't think it was ever mentioned before this. Like they mentioned like a Goblin King and like in being killed like with an army of millions, like in Volume 1, but this is like the first time it's expanded upon.
I'm not sure that's true that the collective memory part wasn't mentioned, but I do agree this is the first like active mentioning of this. And to be honest, the colored text here was also used. So Pirate used another like contextual thing to like point out that this is super important. I also love that scene because she gets challenged. There's this constant refrain in her mind that it's all about survival, fight or die, kill or die, kind of like shakes her. And then the Goblin King reaches out and says, "That's not who we are. Remember." And it's one of the most subtly not unsubtle points that people forget. On the second read, I just realized just how important this point is, and I'd forgotten it. Did you remember it?
I did not. I just remembered it when I read through it.
I mean, it's pretty important, and considering what we find out later about goblins, how did we all forget this, and how did Pirate like incept us into forgetting it? Because this seems like something we wouldn't forget.
It's because there's too many words to remember everything.
You can only blame that so many times. Too many people are like, "I skip every chapter except for the goblins." I mean, what? Why don't you guys remember it? Why?
They're too busy remembering Garen Redfang and, the chieftain of the Goldstone Tribe.
Oh my God, the two of them. Oh. I mean, Garen's appearance in the story is just so cool. His linguistic skills is supposed to be a surprise. Like, it's a big deal that Garen can speak, and I'm like, okay, does this mean Garen's older so he can speak? When I first read it, like, I just assumed that, oh, some goblins speak and some goblins don't. They can just learn how to. And on second read, I was like, oh, goblins have to learn how to speak because they're children, and children have to learn how to speak.
It's so much.
And Pirate just like casually mentions babies are killing each other. You just realize the full enormity of it, but I only realize it later. I in the moment, you don't see it, do you? Did you feel it when you first read it?
I didn't feel like they were children killing each other, but like I still got like that vibe from it. Like with Rags, like Rags was incredibly mature, and you thought she was like she could understand English, and like understand what people were saying. So you understood you thought she was special, but when she met Garen, like you realized that all goblins had this potential. So yeah, I got that vibe, but I didn't exactly like understand it at that moment. I couldn't pass it fully, basically.
There's a lot of like philosophical points in the chapter, like the nature of what a goblin is and why they exist and what drives them. And I do commend Pirate for integrating such strong themes into the goblin storylines. Have you ever done that in your writing, like focus on like thematic aspects that you weave into particular characters or storylines?
I try to do that. Some would say I don't do it that well, but others would say I do, so I don't know if I can do it well. But one of the characters I have in Salvos is like in a constant battle with like depression and like relapse, and like with people who are depressed, you don't just one day suddenly get better. It's like a slow journey, and it's always like one step forward, one step back, two steps forward, one step back. You don't just improve one day, and like it's a realistic this depiction of like depression, and like I think I do it well, but some people just find it frustrating,
I mean, that's what depression is. It's frustrating. When you exist in a depressive state, it's just, if you're somebody who cycles through depression like me, you're going to have those days where you just literally don't have the energy to do anything. And speaking to people is an effort. You have to like marshal all your strength. And it's hard for folks to understand just how limiting depression can be. And chronic depression is even worse because it's never going to go away. You can medicate it, you can come up with strategies, but it's just going to be part of your life forever.
And this character in particular is like he's this is okay, this is a bit of spoiler, but he's an isekai hero. So he comes to this world and like he's like given like amazing powers and like everyone loves him and whatever. And it's like a typical escapist fantasy premise. But the thing is his depression, like which he had even before he isekai'd over, is still there. So like just because you suddenly like are living this escapist fantasy, it doesn't really mean your depression goes away. It's still there. It permeates your life and it affects you even in that kind of an environment.
So, talking about the events of the chapter, it's pretty simplistic, right?
Yeah.
Rags takes her tribe out. She fights the Goldstone tribe, and then once she subdues them, she's really excited because she has Hobbs now, and she has all this large tribe. And then she meets the Red Fangs, and I think this is the first real exploration of goblins who are powerful and successful, and they're presented as extremely good warriors. And then the Red Fang fight her, and she has to go through the internal politics, and she loses the Hobbs, and her tribe is like fucked up. And then the Red Fangs truly challenge her, and she manages to hear that voice that we talked about
Yeah.
of the Goblin King, and she wins. She's gets the Red Fangs to take her as their leader. Now, reasons why is a whole different thing. We never know. But there is one moment where I should mention that was really important for me. Rags names herself Rags in this chapter because shamans are supposed to apparently name kids. She never had the opportunity to have somebody name her, and now she has this person that's named her.
Yeah.
Aaron has named her. And people call her Rags because of Aaron, and she takes the name for herself. So there is that connection between Aaron and Rags in that Aaron gave Rags her name.
I think it's in a thematic sense. It's also like Aaron giving Rags individuality.
Exactly.
Because Rags was just not mindless, but she was like a nameless goblin. She wasn't gonna be Rags before she met Aaron. Right.
Right. And it parallels back to how Erin is changing the world by giving, she gives the chess club their names. She gives Pawn his name. She gives Torin his name. She keeps giving people personality. They already have personality, but giving them a chance to form their own identity. Names are important, as we find out, because, I mean, in a classical sense, as far as we know, magic, names are important, everything's important. Name is a way we identify ourselves, and how we identify ourselves changes based on our personalities, our histories and things. I'm rambling, but the point being, names are important.
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying.
Yeah. Okay, so on to the author note, unless you have anything else to say about the chapter.
No, I agree with you. Like, structure-wise, it was pretty straightforward, but the way it was done, like, emotionally, it was incredible. Like, in terms of structure, it was like, oh, Rags had a win, and then she had a loss, and she had a win. It's like a typical, like, story structure, you know? A three-act story structure. And, but, like, well, what part did was compelling because of how they did it.
Absolutely. So Pirate Abba's author note starts off, woo, running out of steam here.
Oh, this is just every author note, you know, which pirate has ever
Yeah.
left.
This they talk about hitting a certain point for their Patreon numbers and how much sleep they need to write at their best. Apparently 9 hours of sleep is needed. Is that how much sleep you need to write at your best?
I just need, I actually don't need sleep to write my best. I need to be awake for like 4 hours before I can write at my best. So,
Oof, okay. And then Pirate Abba talks about something really interesting. I want to read this part out because I have opinions.
yeah.
This is what Pirate wrote. I've decided that watching Smallville is bad for my mental health. Seriously, it's like Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Does every episode have to have horrible things happen without any good spots? And I thought The Wandering Inn got tough at times. Imagine if every chapter was Erin being horribly stabbed and having her best friend get mad at her and general horribleness. I don't know if you've ever seen Smallville or watched Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
I have not.
Pirate, you have not?
No, I do not consume a lot of Western content. I mean, I'm from Singapore, so like, you know.
Okay, fair enough. You're from Singapore, but let me tell you something. Explore some of it. There's a whole body behind it that kind of informs a lot of the writing. So, like, people like Brandon Sanderson and Patrick Rothfuss grew up on this shit. And
Right.
they read this shit, and then that's how their writing was formed. So oftentimes when what's surprising to it's the same way with like when you're reading Eastern fiction, you want to read some of the more classical not like super far back, but just the classical pop culture stuff, because if you don't know Dragon Ball, you won't know why this exists. If you don't know Bleach, you won't know why this exists.
Yeah. I watched Invincible, if that counts.
Oh, yeah, Invincible is based off of a bunch of older. We're not gonna get into it. Let's stop.
Right.
I loved Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and I loved Smallville when they originally came out. I dropped them both because of the same reason the pirate pointed out, where there was this kind of tendency to fetishize pain.
Torture porn.
What?
Torture porn.
Oh, it wasn't torture porn, but it did fetishize the idea that heroes should suffer too much.
I think I might like that because I really like that idea that heroes have to suffer to get victories.
There's a difference between heroes suffering to accomplish a task or get victory or whatever, and the way Buffy, for example, kind of spent their time saying that life is pain, and the interpretation of that was to just make every character suffer massive psychological and emotional damage. Like, kill your mother, destroy your friends, force you to kill people and hide the bodies, suffer mental breakdowns. The amount of fucked up shit that happens on those shows is just crazy.
Right.
And yet still we love them because they're one of the few representations of in the 90s and 2000s were one of the few representations of comics characters actually experiencing something in a real way. Like, that was it.
Right. I'm not gonna lie. Oh, you're just convincing me to watch it.
I'm happy to have convinced you to watch it. I'm just saying that was what made me drop that. Watching the Dark Willow sequence was so painful because I remember feeling everything she felt, but I didn't go nuts and do all the stuff that she did. Like, ugh.
All right.
It was crazy some of the steps that went through. But you should, if you ever get a chance, you should watch Buffy and Angel especially. Angel was amazing. I was going to go through the comments, but honestly, there's so many comments, and because we messed up a I messed up a little bit on which chapter we were covering today, I don't have any notes from the comments. Do you want to quickly go through? We can spend about 2 minutes, see if you find anything that's like makes you laugh or giggle.
Looking through real quick. Oh, you were right that that was like the first Goblin King stuff because there's a comment saying that more Goblin King stuff like in an excited tone.
I've forgotten about it. Oh, okay.
Oh, people used to think that Rags would become a main villain.
Absolutely. It was one of the primary things. Who wrote that actually in this chapter?
Dragon Zhao. He said, thanks for giving Rags an out of becoming a main villain, or at least delaying it. Oh my god, people really thought Rex was gonna be a main villain.
I mean, yeah, it's a goblin. I think the assumption is always goblins equal evil, even though we know now Pirate Abba likes anti-villains and to make sure the characters have actual motivations and that villainy is not the same thing as antagonism. I mean, Persua is not Rags, is not Azcrash, is not.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, having covered that, let's move on to the next chapter. 2.28. This one is so much fun for me. Because I'm a huge fan of reading and like pop culture and television in general, and it's especially about folklore and stories.
I'm not gonna lie, I didn't like it as much because of the exact same reasons you just listed. I'm not like a fan of the chapters where like there's like pop culture references like to entertain like the characters in world.
Okay, well, in this chapter, I didn't feel like there was a lot of like pop culture-y references in the same way. It was more about I understood what Pirate was doing in having Ryoka sit down and tell stories. That's what appeals to me when Pirate uses references. It's easy to use simple references so long as you have a strong thematic reason for doing it. And this chapter has some great themes to it. So before we get too deep into it, general overview of the chapter. Ryoka has been running forever. She's been going through stuff. Pirate expresses their hatred of insects by talking about frozen fleas, was it?
Yeah.
Or something like that, yeah. And she's being hounded by the Fae, and she's run, and she finally finds relief in the winter with this group called the Stonespears Tribe, who are miners, and they're not the wealthiest or the most powerful, and they occupy the northernmost lands below the Bloodfields. And they're just, they prospect for gemstones, and they have minor classes, and they welcome her into their tribe and give her a place at their fire. And she meets Urx and Mercia.
Mercia.
I don't think we can talk about it too much, but
yeah,
these two characters matter. That much I'll say.
I love all these characters.
Mercia is introduced in this chapter in such a delightful way. She's so childlike. Pirate picked up on that very well.
Yeah.
The bra scene was brilliant. Honestly, the bra scene was so good. And of course, Ryoka having a mental breakdown over everything. Girl.
You know what I like most about this chapter? I liked that it was when Ryoka finally placated the Frost Fairies.
No, she didn't placate the Frost Fairies. Eren did. Eren was the one who got her a small favor, so the Frost Fairies stopped attacking her and driving her, and they, like, threatened to drive her off the face of the world or whatever the fuck it was. And because Eren did a favor, and Ryoka instantly figures out that Eren did the favor.
Yeah, no, but that's not what I was saying. I mean, it's like the first chapter where Ryoka forms like a bond with the Frost Fairies, because before that, every interaction they've had was purely antagonistic.
Okay.
Like the Frost Fairies only stopped attacking Ryoka because of Eren. But then Ryoka started to, like, perform her own magic, because, like, usually it's Eren who's doing, you know, like, the befriending and, like, all that good stuff. But this is, like, the first time which Ryoka was actively trying to achieve this after what happened in Volume 1.
Right.
So it's, like, a big, great character moment for her.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, definitely. The stories that she tells, the way she speaks to the fairies and starts to notice that they value unique... They don't value physical things. They value the kind of memories that you can grant. And Ryoka's smart enough to, like, notice it and tap into it. She tells the story of Superman and Batman. Of course she tells the story of Batman.
Oh my god.
And Lord of the Rings and all that. And I love that Pirate picked a poem to read. I do wonder if there was a particular reason she picked William Blake's Auguries of Innocence. Both Ryoka and Pirate, why they picked it. It's a wonderful poem, but I do wonder about why they picked it. Do you know the poem in question?
I do not.
I'm trying to remember. I should probably have done, like, this is why I hate it when I don't remember what chapter read. I know there's a lot of meaning in every single poem line, and I hate the fact that I didn't look it up beforehand. Maybe I will. I just really love the chapter. There wasn't a lot going on. It's one of those Gilmore Girls episodes where, like, not a lot happens, but a lot happens, you know?
Yeah, I know. I mean, like, if you just, like, ignore, like, all the emotional and character moments, it's basically Ryoka gets up and talks to the Frost Fairies. Like, literally, that's it.
And she meets a bunch of people, she gets to talk to the Frost Fairies, and then the Frost Fairies offer to take her to the place that she's trying to go.
Yeah.
That's it. Those are the three events that happen. But honestly, it's just, there's so much world building going on in this chapter, and I felt not at all annoyed at any of this. I think a lot of people push back on chapters like this because they feel like the chapter should be chugging at 100% all the time. The plot should be chugging at 100% all the time. Do you feel like that's how writing should be? Like, every chapter should always be plot, plot, plot? How do you write?
I heavily disagree. I personally tend to lean more towards writing setups for payoffs, like, in the future. So, but the thing is, I sometimes don't do it well. Like, until recently, if you look at the chapter, it's like a slice of life chapter.
Mm-hmm.
But until recently, like, you know, I couldn't do slice of life very well. Like, if you asked me from, like, a year ago to write a slice of life chapter, it wouldn't be even like a tenth as good as this. But now I think I can write maybe a slice of life chapter maybe half as good as this.
I think it's a matter of practice and skill. There is talent attached to it. Like, you have to have the talent for it. But talent only gets you so far. You still need to practice, and, like,
yeah,
ultimately that's the matter. You have to try it to be able to accomplish it. And I think it's unfair to say that you are unable to do it. It's just
not your particular area of expertise. And if you get the amount of practice, you'll get there, right?
Yeah, no, but like with slice of life, one thing which I misunderstood before, like studying and practicing it more, was that you need character, like very compelling character moments to make the slice of life feel like it's not filler. Like if it's just things which happening which are like without like any character growth moments or resolving any things like which were set up in the past, it would feel like it doesn't matter, it doesn't hold any weight or gravity, which is how I used to write them, which I didn't understand. I couldn't like see things in this way as I do now, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Because did you ever watch Natsume?
No.
Dude.
I feel like this entire podcast has been you asking me if I've done something, and my answer has just been no the entire time.
Oh, you're young. You're young. That's all. I'm teaching things. Let this old man teach you things. So Natsume's best friend or what, book of friends. It's this slice of life anime. It's very atmospheric and about spirits. So there's this kid who can see spirits, and he makes a deal with one of the, sorry, not spirits, yokai, and he makes a deal with this particular yokai because he inherits this book with a bunch of names in it from his grandmother containing the names of various yokai, and this book grants the owner control over the yokai, making it important. And what Natsume does is he, throughout the series, he frees the yokai trapped by returning them their names. And in the process, he makes friends. That's literally the premise of the whole story.
Right.
And you get to watch as he meets all these people, and it's just this fun thing. And there isn't a huge amount. There's only one event that happens. Natsume gives a name back, and yet you're fascinated by the way his life is, and you go through the emotional journey he does and the parallels with his grandmother and all stuff. I'm listing a slice of life animes because you said you were a weeb, okay? Did you at least watch Ascendance of a Bookworm?
Oh, I read the manga for like I think until like part one was over, and like there was like a gonna be like a 1 month wait for like part two of the manga, and I forgot about it by the time part two came out, and I've been like waiting to binge it since.
Did you ever watch Barakamon? The one about calligraphy?
No, I did not.
Oh my god, dude, you gotta watch it. It's a whole thing. And then Silver Spoon, the one about this guy who goes to the school for to learn about farming. And it's literally all about farming. It's okay. You know what? There's just a lot of stuff. But yeah, I agree wholeheartedly with the idea that slice of life anime, the core of it should be the emotional development of the characters.
Yep.
The life they lead doesn't. I love this show called The Crazy Ex-Girlfriend that was created by Rachel Bloom and Aline. I can't remember her last name. It's just this weird pop culture-y show that is like musical comedy, and it was on WB a while back. It only had a couple of seasons, but one of the most important lines from it was when Rachel did this, the show would have different like musical interludes, and in one musical interlude they wrote a song that literally had this line that said, "Life is a series of gradual moments and revelations. There is no narrative structure to it." And that's what I think is the core of slice of life. They don't put narrative structure on anything,
Right.
and they just work between the different points of realization and self-actualization that happen in your existence.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. No, I really do. Like,
I'm just throwing shit at you. You're not Dragonist, so you don't know me well enough to be able to push me back. I'm sorry.
No, I fully agree. That's the thing. Like, we said it earlier, like this chapter didn't have much happening. Like Ryuka told a bunch of stories, she met a few people, but like meeting someone new isn't like inherently interesting. It isn't like there's no tension to it. The only part of tension in this chapter was with the frost fairies.
No, there was one other point of tension. When
Was it with
Mersha,
Mersha?
yeah, when Mersha like snuck up on Ryoka.
But that wasn't really ten. That was like, I wouldn't call it tension the same way the Ryuka's interaction with the Frost Fairies are tension.
Yeah, there isn't an antagonist protagonist tension. It's more like scene tension. But I suppose I'm being nitpicky on that one. Yeah, you're right. It's just the Frost Fairies. And even there, it's not really true tension. It's more about what will Ryoka do to deal with it, not will Ryoka deal with it. Will she succeed? Is she in harm's way, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Okay, so do you want to talk a little bit more? Is there anything else you want to mention about the chapter?
I just want to say that, you know what? I really like how the Frost Fairies talk. I still think that it's one of the best, like Pirate Arba, like, obviously does dialogue incredibly well. When I just started reading, like, The Wandering Inn, you know, I came from light novels, so I was, like, very prose blind, and, like, a lot of characters in, like, light novels talked, like, in the same way. So, like, when Frost Fairies were first introduced, it was, like, my first time seeing, like, a proper attempt at, like, you know, having a different style of dialogue, you know, like, so characters don't just all sound the same.
Delta, you poor, poor child.
Like, have you read a light novel? Oh my god, all the characters sound exactly the same, and it's so frustrating.
The amount of bitching that I have about the difference between light novels and well-written prose, I'm telling you, read the books I recommend. Y'all need to read the books I recommend and learn about good dialogue writing and why I bitch and moan, because it is not easy to write dialogue, but when you do it even remotely well, you create so much more life and color and brightness to your story.
Yeah.
You give life to the person that speaks, and breathing life into that person makes it easier for the reader to breathe life into the story in their mind. Please, light novel writers, Royal Road readers, when I bitch and moan at you, it's not because I hate you, it's because I know you're capable of doing more. Okay. Okay, sorry.
No, that's fine. I'm just looking at if there's anything else which I want to comment about. No, there really isn't anything I want to comment. I could comment about, like, the pop culture stuff, but it wouldn't be anything positive.
I'm not, we're not gonna talk. I mean, Pirate did quote fucking Tolkien and,
yeah,
like, talked about Spider. I do get a little mad that Pirate did not talk about, like, any Marvel people. Didn't talk about the X-Men especially. I feel assaulted by that because the X-Men were such a big deal for my childhood.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I feel insulted. Why couldn't there be a group of people? I don't know. Whatever. And then there's the whole, you know, Ryoka's internal monologue thing, which is...
excellent.
Which is well represented, but...
yeah.
Yeah, that, I'm good, too. Did you see the author note where Pirate posted the Gandalf thing?
I did. I mostly paid attention to what Pirate said.
Go ahead and read.
About hitting $800 on Patreon. But,
go ahead, read it. Read it out loud for the folks.
I'm not doing any more incentive after this one and hitting $800 on Patreon, and here's why. Now about the chapter, I'm so gonna get sued for this, but it's such a good line, and I'm pretty sure it and other songs fall under fair use in a sense. It might be that there's a good case against my using them, since this is a book or at least a story, but they are meant to be references and clearly labeled as such. And you know what? I'm hoping I can leave it in. Anyway, the scene in Ryoka references comes from this moment in Lord of the Rings, and Pirate links to Gandalf saying that the journey does not end here.
Hmm. One of the, I suppose that's great, but I was super interested by the incentive post too. Pirate hyperlinked to a complete message explaining why they took down the incentives page and their philosophy on how they write. They didn't, like, they were talking about, like, keeping the incentive page and then, and the TV tropes page, and they were building, like, stuff. Honestly, though, do you agree with what Pirate wrote? Is that your philosophy when it comes to the business of writing? What's your opinion on what they said?
I'm reading through it now. I didn't read them this earlier.
Oh, yeah. I thought it was pretty important, if only because... and now I know why I picked these chapters, because Pirate did this, and I wanted to talk to you about this. Essentially, it's like bonus chapters, and then they... This was back in, like, 2017, so this was when the early days of how Patreon and bonus chapters were going to work were setting up.
No, I get it. Like even back then, like $800 on Patreon for a web serial author was like a ton of money.
Yeah, and Pirate was trying to monetize and figure out the strategy for how to do it. And eventually they did land on their current model, but what do you think of Pirate's model? What do you think of like web novel people like incentivizing things by creating extra chapters? How do you like this model? What do you think about it?
I like Pirate's model because it's very simplistic and it appeals like more to the author than like to the readers. It's in a sense, Pirate is not limiting their creative freedom. Like they I wouldn't say they aren't doing it for just money, but like and I wouldn't say like a lot of web serial authors are just doing it for money either. But like Pirate is like prioritizing the story over, making more money potentially, and I really admire them for it. Like they want, obviously, like the reason they had the incentives page in the first place was because they wanted to make more money. They wanted to like have like obviously like a livable income.
Hang on, I think that's part of it, but the incentive page also incentivized people to leave reviews and work on the TV tropes page. And if you did enough, that Pirate would write more. And it kind of created this odd dynamic where Pirate was transforming their, I think, from my perspective, was they were transforming their fan base into little worker bees and then working extra hard for them. And they didn't want that kind of dynamic with their fans. And I think that's reasonable, right?
Yeah, they were trying to basically reward the fans for like advertising their thing, their story for free. But you want it to be natural. You want like your readers to advertise your story because they love the story, not because they have something to gain.
Right, and it creates, well, yeah, it's weird dynamic. You don't want your fans to see you as anything other than the writer, and you don't want pressure on your writing ability to be contingent on the ability of people to sell your work. Your work should at least somewhat be able to sell itself, right?
Yeah, and like as someone who is sometimes is I tend to like overpromise and underdeliver. So like just yesterday I told my readers I'd have a chapter out by like 6 p.m. and I ended up getting it out like 6 hours later. And like having the pressure there, like it keeps me motivated. It helps me keep on writing, but there are times where like I just write and like I'm not feeling it, and I know it could be better, but I'm forced to write through it. So like alleviating the pressure, which is what Pirate did by removing this incentive page, is something which I can completely understand. Recently, one thing I did, which a lot of people may not agree with, is I removed any sort of schedule from my Patreon and Royal Road page. So if you look at me, I will try to get like chapters out in the same schedule as I previously promised them, but I don't work on a schedule anymore. I just write whenever I want to.
I don't really love that whole like on I think you're okay. I'm gonna relate it through another writer I work with, Casual Farmer. So this is gonna make me sound like I name drop a lot, but I don't fucking care. So Casual Farmer gets a lot of pressure to deliver because he writes on a 3 day a week chapter release schedule, and it's a hard thing to do because the quality of the work has gone up over time, and the demands on that to maintain that quality goes up over time. It doesn't decrease, and your writing schedule has to meet that quality, be able to release on time. I'm not sure it's a sustainable model for a lot of writers once they reach a certain point. I don't know how most web serial writers do it. Actually, I do know. You know too. They end up fucking up the quality of their work in return for just producing stuff. And I think that's bad. And I think that's bad. You have to find the balance. You have to maintain some level of quality. And I think Pirate chose the right path to work on the quality of their work rather than pump out more, you know? Which I know we're talking about Pirate Abba writes 100,000 words a month, but
Oh my God. They write like 200,000 words a month, not 100,000. 100,000 is what I do. I average like 100 to 150,000 words. Pirate average is like 150 to like 250,000 words.
and they now have like a full-on team of people who work behind the scenes to like edit, and they go through like two different iterative processes to like properly make sure the scene structure, and they're still doing most of the work by themselves.
Yeah.
It is insanity. I don't know a lot of web serial writers who work to that level. Maybe Casual Farmer because I'm involved in it, but I think every writer at some point has to get beta readers and to like lengthen the process of their writing.
I know a lot of authors who have it, like, for example, like Selkie Myth. You might know him. He's in the One Million Silver as well. McCanimus writes A Journey of Black and Red, and Calamitous Bob on Royal Road. Those are some examples of, like, Shirtaloon. He also has, like, a group of beta readers, but they are, like, readers, random readers he picked out. They are his friends, which he trusts.
Mm-hmm.
For me, personally, I don't like beta readers. I don't like having outside input on what I can do, except if it's I don't know, like, I really don't like getting outside input, like, for my story. Like, I know that sounds like I'm shooting myself on the foot, but if a reader suggests something, I'm more likely not to do it because I'm a bit of a contrarian. So, like, if someone tells me, oh, you should do this, like, even if I had previously planned it, I'm like, maybe I won't do it. And I don't like having that influence on me. So I stay away from beta readers.
It's your process. Whatever feels comfortable to you is what works for you. When I speak of the beta readers and editors, I'm thinking of the quality of the, like, the... So there's a vast difference between, oh, this is one of those things I wish I planned to talk about before in the comment structure for one of the chapters I thought it was today.
Yeah.
But there's a difference between telling a writer that the scene is wrong and showing a writer how a scene could develop differently and letting them make that choice.
No, I understand that. I had beta readers for one of my stories, like, for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't like the process. I just couldn't get into it. Like, these were good beta readers, by the way. They offered good advice, gave me, like, good feedback. But if I had beta readers, I wouldn't have them, like, to give suggestions. I would just have them to give their reactions to the chapter, like, whether what I conveyed was conveyed right.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, when you have a beta reader, you have to define the feedback that works for you. And if the feedback that works for you is, here is what I'm trying to hit, did I hit it? If they say no, or it felt wrong, and here's why I think it felt wrong, and then you use that to figure out how to make it hit the points that you do, that's what I consider good feedback. The point of a beta reader group should be to support the writer's plans, not to change the way the writer writes or to change what they're writing.
Yeah, no, I get that. I get that.
Anyway, I'm arguing for a beta reader group. The only reason I'm saying this shit is because I find this topic fascinating.
Yeah.
The writing process is fascinating.
No, most of my, like I told you, Selkie, he advocates having a beta readers like a ton. A lot of authors I know, they really advocate it. I am, like, one of the few in the camp who is against beta reading. So I'm just a bit odd in that sense.
I don't know. It's about the process that you go through and about figuring out how to integrate tools into it. If it's a tool that doesn't help you, then you just have to find a different way to achieve the same results, you know?
Yeah.
If you can't hit that point, you'll figure it out. But we're coming to a close on the episode, and generally we close out the episode by... We didn't read any reader emails the last couple of weeks because we've been doing Volume 8. And we didn't really have a lot of reader emails, but do you want to ask our audience a question and see if they have a response for you? We'll read it out loud. Maybe you get to find out all about it.
I don't have a question yet, but...
Okay, I have one, though.
Yeah.
If there's a pop culture reference in The Wandering Inn that you would like to see, like, I wanted Pirate to talk about the X-Men. What do you guys want them to talk about?
I'll ask a question about the goblins. Did you guys like the old goblin chapters? Because from when I read The Wandering Inn, I loved, like, every single goblin chapter, even especially, like, in Volume 5, which is, I know I'm skipping ahead, but, like, all the way back in Volume 2, Volume 1, like, the Rags chapters were literally my second favorite chapters aside from Eren chapters. It was Eren, Rags, Ryoka, Pisces. The clown chapters were, like, very recent, so...
We haven't gotten there yet.
Have we not gotten there?
Oh, yeah, actually, we have. When this episode comes out, it'll be after the clown episode. Sorry. Yeah, we've gotten there.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, so like I really love the Reg's chapters, but apparently in like Oshi, for example, doesn't like them. Didn't like the early Goblin chapters, and a lot of people in the Wandering Inn's Discord, when I first joined it, I was shocked to discover a lot of people hated it. So I'm just curious what the proportion of like fans to quote unquote
Non-fans?
haters, you know.
Oh, okay. Haters.
I won't call this. There's like a quotation marks around it. All right.
Okay, haters is a strong word. I said I dislike the chapters because I dislike the. I understand the skill and ability that takes for Pirate to write it. I just dislike. Where. Okay, Ling Ling Shield, for anybody who knows that reference. I don't dislike the goblins. I don't dislike their chapters.
You just don't like them.
Yeah, I don't like them. Like most of the goblin characters don't appeal to me. That's the problem.
They don't stand out. Yeah, so
No.
I'm just curious about the ratio of those who have that same like mindset where it's like unappealing versus those who were like me and absolutely adore them.
All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening in, and thank you so much for coming on as a guest, Delta. I hope you come back when Dragnus is here so you can hear us argue about it a little bit too.
Yeah, just let me know whenever that happens.
Do you want to plug anything? Your stories, any Twitter handle or anything like that?
Not really. Here's the thing I want to plug. You guys should vote on Top Web Fiction for The Wandering Inn more. Like you know, you guys have been slacking. The Wandering Inn is like it's not even in the top, not even in the top three right now. It's currently number four. You guys gotta get back to work.
Okay, you know what? You hear that, Dragoness? Where is your campaign to get the Wandering Inn at the top, number one of the top web fiction?
Exactly.
I don't see it happening. Dragoness promised this when we started the podcast early on. It has not happened. It's not materialized. I've created a whole podcast. I've done lots of things. Where's his thing?
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks. Thanks for listening, everybody. Say bye, Dragoness. Oh, wow. I just said say bye, Dragoness. It's say bye, Delta.
I see how it is. I'm just standing for Dragoness, I guess. All right, goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to No Killing Goblins,
edited by Discanter.
The music on No Killing Goblins was composed by System Glitch. They can be found at youtube.com/systemglitch. You can get in touch with us via our Twitter at No Killing Goblin, or email us at nokillinggoblins with an S at gmail.com.